go ahead and get started, just go ahead and take your time.
Yeah.
All right, we're back on the record, and the time is about 2:44 p.m. Central Time. And at this time, Ms. Valley, I believe you were calling Sharon, is it Koenig?
Thank you, Your Honor. It's Sharon Koenig.
Koenig. Thank you. Ms. Koenig? Ms. Koenig, I believe you were present earlier when I instructed about penalties for perjury. Were you not?
Yes, I was.
All right. Thank you. Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth under pains and penalties of perjury?
I do.
Thank you. And Ms. Paulson is passing out your witness statement, I believe. And this will be, okay, I have to look at my list here to see what number we're at. NSP Exhibit 26. And Mr. Norell, do you have any objections to this exhibit?
No, Your Honor.
All right, NSP 26 is admitted. Please proceed, Ms. Valley.
Ms. Koenig, your pre-filed written testimony has been stipulated into the record in this proceeding. Do you have any corrections to your written testimony today?
No.
And would you please proceed with your opening statement?
My name is Sharon Koenig, and I hold the position of Director of Compensation for Xcel Energy. My purpose in this proceeding is to provide testimony to demonstrate the reasonableness of the company's annual incentive program and nuclear retention program costs. For individual but related reasons, these programs are necessary to attract, retain, and engage highly skilled employees that help provide reliable electric service throughout our system each day. Delivering safe and reliable electric service to our North Dakota customers is dependent upon attracting talented employees to our company in the present and upon planning for the long-term success of the utility. I'm concerned that we would not be able to attract and retain capable employees in a consistent manner unless we continue to offer total cash compensation, meaning the combination of base salary and incentive compensation, that is competitive with what is offered elsewhere in the market. We therefore utilize industry best practices to compare our total cash compensation for a position to what is offered in the marketplace for the same or similar jobs. By that objective measure, we know that without annual incentive, our employees' cash compensation would be 14 to 17% below that which comparable utilities pay. That would be like paying our employees $85 for a job that elsewhere would pay $100. Furthermore, the annual incentive is a prevalent compensation tool used by corporations and utilities alike for the dual purposes of motivating employees to attain business goals that benefit customers and managing the overall costs of employee compensation. Because incentive compensation must be newly earned each year, and because certain employee benefit costs increase as base pay amounts increase, our annual incentive is more cost-effective than providing cash compensation solely through base salary. As a human resources professional, I'm concerned about any potential inability to recover incentive compensation costs that are designed to help us fairly compensate and motivate employees, and at the same time serve to manage the overall cost of employee compensation. To further manage costs and provide value for our North Dakota customers, we are not seeking 100% of our annual incentive costs. Instead, we propose to cap our recovery of these costs at 25% of base pay. This cap essentially precludes rate recovery of costs of providing incentive compensation to executive-level employees, while recognizing that it is reasonable to recover the cost of incentives for those skilled employees in a variety of other jobs so they have the opportunity to receive market-level cash compensation. We have also aligned our annual incentive program with the goals that benefit our customers, such as safety and reliability standards. For each of these reasons, I believe that our annual incentive program provides significant overall benefits to our customers, that program costs are reasonable, both in the nature and the amount of the costs, and the rate recovery in North Dakota is appropriate. Similarly, our nuclear incentive programs are designed to help us retain employees who are in key positions in our nuclear business. My testimony provides information about our recent experiences with critical nuclear employees leaving the company and describes the limited pool of skilled nuclear industry employees for which we compete. While we have had some success when utilizing retention programs for our nuclear programs, we have struggled to hire needed employees where other utilities were able to implement retention programs ahead of us. In combination with the annual incentive, our nuclear retention programs align employee interests with nuclear operational goals, reduce significant costs of employee turnover, and ensure employee stability in this particularly complex and highly unique area of our business.
Thank you. Ms. Koenig is available for cross.
Thank you, Ms. Valley. Mr. Norrell, question?
Thank you, Your Honor. Ms. Koenig, how long have you been employed by Xcel or NSP?
I actually started with the company earlier this year in March.
Did the other company, did you work for another company prior to coming to Xcel?
Yes, I've been in working in the compensation field for about the last 13 years at other corporations in the Minneapolis marketplace, and then in addition to my full corporate career since college.
Okay. Did any of the other companies you work for have incentive programs?
Yes, all of them did.
Okay. And how did they compare to the one that we're discussing here with Xcel or NSP? I'm sorry.
Well, I can say that all of the other companies that I worked at that had in the compensation field had incentive programs that had predetermined goals that they set out each year, and a certain number of employees were eligible for those opportunities to pay out incentive. And while that varied from industry to industry, it was a really prevalent practice that was in addition to paying base salaries, such as increasing with merit pay and so on.
And is that how the NSP incentive pay is generally structured, or is structured in general?
Well, our compensation philosophy is that we pay, we look to median pay practices and look to total cash compensation that is comparable in our utility company market where we compete for talent. So we do look to salary surveys that compare us with other utility companies.
Okay. Could you explain kind of in a nutshell, what the compensation, the incentive compensation policy is for NSP? What kind of, you mentioned certain things need to be met. What needs to be met? What kind of goals?
I can explain our general parameters of our annual incentive program. We call it AIP, and it is the short-term incentive that we utilize to motivate employee behavior with performance metrics. So it is an annual incentive. It is different from a bonus. It is really setting out predetermined metrics that are in place, and we have really three elements that we look to when we set these performance criteria. We look to corporate-level metrics or a scorecard, business unit-level scorecard metrics, and also an individual component that is tied to the individual employee's performance.
What kind of items would go under that individual component?
Well, the individual component would be for our employees. Similar to other companies, we have a performance rating where we assess the individual's performance throughout the whole performance cycle, and generally that's a fiscal year in the case of our company. And between the individual and their leader or their department they work for or their business unit, there are certain individual goals that they aspire to throughout the year. And so, like many other companies, we have performance ratings, and those performance ratings are assessed and really through a performance management system. They're discussed throughout the year, but mostly at a year end, that assessment is done through an annual performance review and in which we rate our employees.
Do you do any sort of surveying of your employees, or is it part of this annual review of as to their mentality within the workforce? How do they like working for NSP, and what things do they like working about that, about NSP?
Well, not specifically to my department in compensation, but in HR in general. We do employee engagement surveys at our organization, and that speaks to a number of characteristics, including their engagement level and their satisfaction level.
Do the engagement level and satisfaction level have any sort of impact on their compensation? Is there any trade-off there or any correlation between the two?
Well, we do certainly want our employees to respond with their engagement scores. So we certainly promote them engaging in those surveys throughout the year. We do them annually, and on occasion we also do pulse surveys in the middle of the year. But your question is specific, I believe, to is there any impact related to compensation? And in fact, to be an employer of choice, one thing that we strive for is to make sure that we do have engaged and motivated employees. And so one of the scorecard metrics that we have is a very small portion of our corporate scorecard is related to employee engagement.
Do you guys look to other besides compensation, do you look to other things to help keep employees engaged, such as opportunities to learn or develop their career, flexible hours, recognition, any of that sort of issue?
Yes, many of the things that you mentioned are things that we certainly provide to make sure that we have a good total rewards experience, and not only total rewards, but also really what is that work experience for our employees. And so you mentioned a couple items like recognition. We do have a recognition program where we are able to give kind of on-the-spot thanks and appreciation for a job well done. We also offer development and training, and really as part of that performance management process, one element that leaders are held accountable to for their employees is to make sure that they're looking to continue to develop their employees as well. So there's a continual check-in between a leader and their employee on not only performance, but also how is their development plan going. And there are many training opportunities that are available to our employees to allow them to continue to develop.
Are there any sort of outside studies, third-party studies that you're aware of that have been conducted to determine how an employee's work experience at NSP compares to an employee at Otter Tail or other like-minded companies?
I'm not sure that I'm aware of those studies about how our engagement scores compare to other engagement scores in the utility industry, but because I haven't heard of them doesn't mean that they might not exist.
Well, there was a lot of talk earlier about the Wisconsin Commission disallowing the incentive payments. Are you familiar with that situation, and can you testify to any reasons why Wisconsin would have disallowed those?
I can tell you that I'm familiar with the matter regarding Wisconsin, and I know that while I'm not involved in the details of that case, I am aware that that decision about allowance of AIP was probably done in connection with an array of other decisions, not just solely on the purpose of whether AIP should be allowable for recovery. So that's about the extent I'm familiar with that case. I'm not involved in that one specifically.
So you don't know what the particular concerns that Wisconsin had with the AIP in Wisconsin, in that Wisconsin case, were?
I individually don't know. I'm sorry.
You've mentioned, and it's been mentioned in your testimony, that the incentive pay is offered each and every year, that employees essentially need to re-earn that. Is that correct?
Yes, it is what we call variable pay versus fixed pay, which is part of one's annual base salary. So incentive pay is what we call variable, meaning they do have to re-earn that opportunity and for performance outcomes.
In your rebuttal testimony, there's conversation about the nuclear incentive programs. Are those structured under the same kind of umbrella or guidelines as the regular AIP?
Well, what I can explain a little further is that the retention program was put in place. It is a compensation tool that's used to make sure that we are looking at skilled and critical talent that we have in our workforce and making sure that we work towards retaining them. So it is a compensation tool that we use called retention to make sure that we're putting some focused area on those employees. However, it's not directly associated with a broader aspect of our annual incentive program, if I understood your question correctly.
I guess my question, kind of in line of the, if AIP needs to be re-earned every year, your testimony talks about long-term incentives to nuclear employees. How do those two mesh? If it needs to be re-earned, how can you have a long-term incentive?
Well, let me explain a little further about the construct of that nuclear retention program. So it is in part performance-based. So setting aside the annual incentive program for a moment, which is an annual opportunity that we provide eligible employees, what occurred with our nuclear retention efforts would be that we put in place certain for certain key positions, as Mr. O'Connor explained further or earlier in his testimony, that we wanted to make sure that we were retaining them and making sure we continue to have that good investment in their development and that continuity in their work with us. So we put in place a variety of different mechanisms in place with that retention. We used a time-based cash component that was put in place to make sure that we have some continuity. But more importantly, we put in place some performance-based awards in addition to that were connected to KPIs, key performance indicators, that they coordinated with their leadership. The LTI that was given to them, called retention stock units, that is also a performance-based award. So it is not. It is stock related. It is not cash, and that is triggered around a 3-year performance cycle on EPS.
Okay. On page 6 of your testimony, at line 23, you state that there's a cost savings that occurs in the form of reduced cash compensation. Do you have any sort of charts or anything that you can show how much money is saved up front on in the form of reduced cash compensations, or do you know what that dollar amount is?
I don't have that calculation with me, but you know, if we are providing incentive compensation, for example, at a percentage of, let's just say, 10% AIP opportunity of someone's base pay, if we weren't providing an annual incentive plan opportunity for them to re-earn that award each year, if we were to transfer that to their base salaries, it would be about a 10% difference, because we do strive in our compensation philosophy to pay total cash compensation at median pay practices. So if that can give you a good if that gives you a good gauge of what difference that might be, that would show an individual kind of employee example.
So then is your rate, your base pay, is lower than what the median is?
Can you restate that question, please?
You'd mentioned the incentive compensation. I guess my question is, so you start the person with a lower base pay, their cash compensation is going to be lower than what their peers elsewhere might be receiving. Is that correct? Did I understand you correctly?
If I could clarify that a little further, that's not exactly what I meant by that. So let me break it out a little further. When we talk about total cash compensation, that is data that we are able to look to and attain from third-party salary surveys. We also receive information in those surveys about base salary information. So you really see all components of what is being delivered competitively: base pay, annual incentive, and then the sum of those two would be called total cash compensation. And I believe you were making a statement, do we start people lower on the base salary? We don't have that philosophy, but what we do is we want to make sure that we're setting our salary structures based on what we are seeing delivered compared to those market studies as base salary levels. And then we look to set our incentive plan target opportunities also consistent with what we're seeing in the surveys. So our entire compensation philosophy is to make sure that we're monitoring what our median pay practice is, and we look to see that total package, which is called total cash compensation for the majority of our employees.
Have there been any years recently where the company has not provided AIP to employees?
Well, as you noted earlier, I'm new to the company, but what I understand is that while the AIP, the Annual Incentive Program, has been an opportunity that's been offered, I believe there was a prior year that was not paid out. But I don't have the specifics of that with me.
Is there still an annual cost of living pay increase or something comparable to that for NSP employees, just aside from the AIP?
No, I'm not familiar with that. When we structure our market-based compensation programs, we do set those programs up for our non-bargaining employees, and so I'm not aware of any historical cost of living adjustment that would also have been added onto that for our non-bargaining employees.
On page 7, line 4 of your testimony, you state that incentive compensation tends to reduce benefit costs. How does that work?
Sure, I can explain that a little further. If we weren't able to provide a program, including our annual incentive program, in order to continue to retain our talent and motivate people and attract new talent to the company, we would still look to those market surveys to provide median competitive total cash compensation. So if we didn't have our AIP, for example, available to us and we, you know, just hypothetically paid everything in base salaries, we would really be raising the cost of the total administrative costs of our company because an employee's base salary is a factor in how we determine other benefits payable, such as on our pension or certain insurance coverages that we have or opportunities in our health and welfare plans. And so ultimately that employee's base salary can be a factor in determining those other costs. So we see that as if we didn't have the AIP and we still had our objective to pay a median total cash compensation, we'd really be probably raising those costs of the organization in our total rewards program.
Do you know or do you have a document that can show how much savings there are in this terms in reducing the benefit costs on a yearly basis because of the AIP program?
I haven't prepared that, so I don't have that number or that document.
Your Honor, advocacy staff would like to request, if it's at all possible, a document that goes to that effect, the two questions, the one to see the savings in the form of reduced cash compensation, and maybe in the same one, the reduction benefit cost or the reduction in benefit costs as a late file exhibit.
Savings in the form of reduced cash compensation and a reduction in benefits cost?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that what you said? All right. Ms. Valley, any objection to having an exhibit prepared?
Just one moment, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor. I guess one question I would actually like to pose to Ms. Koenig is if she understands what's being asked and if she thinks that this is something that they can put together. It's as she explained, there are a lot of programs affected by this and thousands of employees. So it sounds like a somewhat complicated calculation, so I wanted to clarify.
So what I can address is that while I understand the methodology of how that would be put together, I think you are correct, Ms. Valley, that all of those aspects would not be in my total control of putting them together. I guess I would need to make sure I understand from my other colleagues who are in the retirement benefits and health and welfare to figure out how we would calculate that. So I would not be the expert to be able to pull all that data together myself solely.
So we certainly want to make this a full and complete record and provide all of the information that the commission would like to see in making its final determination. I guess with respect to this particular request, because it does sort of stretch across a variety of areas, that perhaps maybe there be some acknowledging what Mr. Norell has identified here as the rate request, but maybe some flexibility to work with them if there are some modifications that need as we identify what information we have and how it can be compiled for this exhibit.
Sure. Are you saying, Ms. Valley, that it seems overly broad and you're not sure what specifics are being requested?
Well, it sounds like what Mr. Norell would like are the savings that we experience by reduced base pay and having that separation between base pay and AIP and how that also carries over into reduced benefit costs. And I just want to be clear that because we don't have all of the individuals with that information currently present, I don't myself, and it sounds like Ms. Koenig doesn't know what the complexity and feasibility of pulling that analysis together is. So I just want to make sure that everybody is aware that we'll certainly make our best efforts, but as we identify what that information might be, maybe a little work with the advocacy staff to come up with something that is representative of what they're looking for.
Sure. You're asking for maybe an opportunity to work with the staff to get more clearly identified what information they're looking for and what the parameters are. Does that sound reasonable, Mr. Norell, or can you shed a little more light on it?
Well, the testimony just states in numerous places it saves costs. We'd just like to see in what way, but we would be willing to work with Excel, NSP for some to get something. Just we'd like to see some numbers other than just stating broadly it saves costs.
Okay. All right. Sounds like there's some agreement too. Sure, Commissioner Kalk.
It sure be nice if you had you've got your bargaining employees, your non-bargaining employees, you got different management. But I wouldn't think all the employees, but some classes. If this type of class employee, you might save 8%. In this class employee, you might save 2%. In this class, you might not save anything. But I don't know if that would be overly complex to break your employees into their classes, which are probably already. Muddies the water. I think you're just trying to get a feel for just quantify some of those statements.
Yeah, I guess are we looking at a minute cost saving here with AIP? Are we looking at this class of organized labor employees, for example? Are we looking at 8%, 2%? Nothing, too overly complex. Just
so you're saying you don't necessarily need to see, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 employees. Broken out on a chart and what each of the savings are, but something, a lot more condensed than that. And as I think Commissioner Kalk, I think that's a good way to explain that what you're looking for is kind of classes and basically the information savings in that manner. But again, working, with staff to kind of see that this is, you're getting something usable. All right. That would be a late filed exhibit, obviously, since they need to compile the information. I will admit that as Exhibit E. And I'll just write up a description. All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Norell?
Thank you, Your Honor. On page 3 of your testimony, you state that the Wisconsin decision regarding the incentive pay is under review. I know you very kind of spoke to this. Do you know any details about what is exactly under review about that?
No, I'm sorry. I don't have any further insights on it.
Okay. All right. I have no further questions.
Thank you. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle.
Who would know the answer to the under review question? That was one of my questions also. Under review by the company or Wisconsin, or who would know in who's here today from NSP? Attorney?
Ms. Valley, do you have any suggestions of who may have more insights on that? I'm sorry, I don't know.
Your Honor.
Up tomorrow.
This is Carrie. Valley, to the extent, I actually would maybe like a little bit more clarification of what they're looking for in terms of the Wisconsin decision that is included as an attachment to Ms. McCartan's testimony, which lays out the decision-making of that commission.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, could you restate your question, rephrase it?
My question was, I mean, I understand that the case is attached to McCartan's testimony. I looked at the case, but I did also have the same question about it being with the statement that it was under review. And I asked, because you just answered Mr. Norrell, that you didn't know what under review meant, and I'd like to know if anybody at NSP or in the room can answer the question, what does under review mean?
Are you asking the attorney or the witness?
I'm asking the witness has already answered that she does not know, and I am asking the attorney to tell us if there is another witness who can answer that question or if the attorney can express what under review means.
Hey, Ms. Valley.
Thank you, Your Honor. And perhaps we can, as Ms. Koenig is not able to respond to that question right now, we'll follow up, and maybe in our next break we'll identify who could answer that question going forward.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
And you did previously respond that you weren't familiar with the decision in Wisconsin, but having looked at that decision, and it can speak for itself, but the commission, the Wisconsin Commission, says it's too inextricably linked the performance, the stock performance, or the return performance, I should say, is too linked to the plan for the commission to approve it. What I would like to know is your description of the linkage between the plan and company performance.
Well, I can explain my review of the annual incentive program and what those metrics are. I can explain further that it is based on three types of KPIs that are put together based on scorecards. There's a corporate scorecard.
But KPI means what?
Key performance indicator. And so those are generally goals that are set that are monitoring performance, and leaders select what those goals are as they are applicable to their business. So there are corporate scorecard key performance indicators, there are business unit key performance indicators that are structured, and then the third component would be the individual performance of the employee. So the AIP is structured to be a performance-based incentive, and it takes into account those three areas. And individuals are weighted on them separately. And then there is also a funding factor that is related to a minimum EPS target. So that is a funding factor that makes sure that we have affordability to pay the annual incentive each year.
And which of those are tied to the company's performance as far as return earnings?
If your question is whether the EPS is tied to corporate performance, the answer is yes.
Yes, and I was asking you to tell me, for the record, which of the factors you just mentioned is that factor, that first one, corporate performance, not the business unit performance or the individual.
The funding factor ability applies to the corporate scorecard. But what I may add too is that that minimum threshold of EPS needs to be met in order for any payout under the AIP to any employee.
What is the North Dakota precedent for the company on incentive pay?
I believe we are asking for an opportunity to get recovery on annual incentive program up to a cap of 25% of base salaries. I believe historically it was up to 15%.
And for all employees or for a portion of the employees? Are you, and that question applies to what you're asking for and what the North Dakota precedent is.
We are asking for a recovery on annual incentive program up to a cap of 25% of base salaries for those employees who are eligible.
For everyone who is on the incentive plan.
That's correct.
And is the North Dakota precedent 15% for everyone or 15% for a smaller group?
I'm sorry, I don't have the history to answer that question.
I would like to add that to the list of questions that NSP should answer when they figure out who can answer that. Please. Is it impossible to pay only base pay, your total compensation as a base pay? Is it impossible to have a plan that only pays that, not incentive, but still be tied to performance?
I think your question is relating to if we look at only if we only paid our exempt employees base salary and not an annual incentive opportunity. I believe your question is it, are you able to tie that to performance? We wouldn't be able to, I mean, certainly that's a design question. And I guess certainly what we look to, how we, hold employees accountable for performance with their base pay is something that we deliver in an annual merit review. So performance ratings do impact individuals on their base salary with respect to their individual performance rating every year. And so, in fact, today for our base salaries, people are impacted by their performance rating. But if you wanted to design a program that is based on broader group metrics, I think it might be a little difficult to do that just based on base salary.
Aren't the problems, I mean, anybody who's ever managed anybody, I think, would know the answer to this. Aren't the problems exactly the same? The challenges of tying pay to performance, the same whether you're paying base pay or you're paying base plus incentive?
Well, there are, I'm sorry, can you restate your question?
The challenges of trying to tie pay to performance are the same, are they not? Whether you are only trying to do it as a base salary or trying to do it as an incentive plan. The challenges, the hurdles, the hard part of doing it is the same, is it not?
Well, I guess I would respond to that, you know, certainly doing performance management and applying performance ratings to employees' performance throughout the year is a challenge for any business leader. But there are ways that you could do it objectively. And actually, when you look at performance-based incentives like an annual incentive program and you have quantifiable, objective scorecard metrics, you actually have something to look to that is a little bit more objective versus subjective. So when I look to how we rate our employees and we assess what they should receive for a merit increase and whether they earn that merit increase each year based on their performance rating, that is based on providing leaders with good training about how to assess performance, but it is in a bit subjective. Versus when we look at performance metrics that are outlined in an annual incentive program, those are based on quantifiable things that we can measure. So I guess I would say that it's a little easier to really conduct a pay-for-performance culture when we have quantifiable metrics to look to versus subjective.
Thank you. I had the same question as Mr. Norell about the cost benefit, about the cost savings. But I have a follow-up question, even though I'm looking forward to that exhibit, and that is, doesn't the company need to know if there's going to be a cost savings before it decides to go to an incentive pay plan? I mean, isn't that the question that company should be asking itself initially?
Yes, that is part of an analysis that one would do if you haven't already created an annual incentive program. If you were an employer and you were looking to how to restructure or redo compensation programs, yes, any type of modeling is a good thing to conduct if you're deciding how shall I invest our dollars, should I put them into fixed pay such as base salaries versus variable pay, such as annual incentives, versus even long-term incentives. But I think what designers do when they look at how to construct a market-competitive pay package, we look to what are those drivers that are going to provide the operations of the company with the best outcomes. And there are many good reasons why we have base salaries, and we look every year to how a company or an employee is performing, and we give them the opportunity to earn a merit increase. However, the benefits of doing an annual incentive plan are what we talked about earlier, which is you have to re-earn that outcome every year, but it also drives higher levels of performance. You can very much distinguish those employees who are really going above and beyond and performing well versus employees who are performing more at just baseline levels. So there are a lot of reasons why incentive plans are put in place. It's to distinguish performance, but it's also so the company can achieve higher than planned performance outcomes.
And that's what we're asking. The company, that should be a continually ongoing assessment of whether it's worth sticking with this plan or not, correct? So the company should be providing that information to us, and I guess I'm thinking it shouldn't be that hard to come up with. If the company is looking at each year, is this still the plan we want to use? Or should we redesign it? Is it producing the results we think? Is it producing the cost savings or the performance? There should be some way that the company can give us that information.
Well, and what I would add to you, and I know you had requested this information, as did the other gentleman, for additional follow-up, but what I can respond to about should the company be looking at the design of how we deliver pay, we do that annually, and we do get information out of surveys to find out with companies similar in our size, in our utility industry, what is that mix of pay that we're delivering? And we do see that it's very prevalent to have both base salaries, incentive opportunity, and in certain levels at executives, even mid-management and higher, long-term incentives in the form of stock or other performance-based incentives. So we do assess that each year and find out if that is a prevalent practice in companies similar to our size.
And then do you also assess in any summary fashion the productivity changes? Is that something you could provide?
Well, one thing that these key performance indicators that we mentioned, KPIs, those are used in our annual incentive program, but they're used for much more at our company as well. They assess how we're performing and how we're providing service to our customers and how the business is operating. So those are activities that business leaders are going with to assess how is performance on safety and reliability and other business operating activity, and they do assess whether they are making improvements in those areas. And so if I think that speaks to your question about are we seeing that there's a gain or a good outcome in providing those types of performance.
It does, but can you produce any supporting documentation that would be simple, that would be clear and simple data to support the assertion? I don't know what the company might produce that you could turn into us so that we could see what you're saying is happening.
And perhaps that could be something that we could look to help provide you with some background there. But other companies like ours who practice market-based compensation, they do similar steps that we do each year. We look to third-party surveys to find out, is this a prevalent practice? The mix of pay that we're delivering, who we deliver pay to, and in what forms, and what are those median pay practices? So other companies that are doing that kind of activity are kind of conducting the same steps we are when we say that we're market-based. We're looking to those surveys. And I think what you're asking for is specifically the quantifiable outcomes. But I think that's a little bit beyond the compensation design that we look to and how we set these compensation programs up.
Okay, thank you. That's all.
Thank you. This time, then, we'll go to the commission. Commissioner Fedorchik.
Sharon, I'm not a human resource expert, so you'll have to bear with me as I get up to speed on some of your terminology. Okay, so just to make it really simple, in the total compensation packages, I'm kind of assuming there's three things: the base pay, benefits, and AIP. In general, those are the company's expenses.
Well, that would be what we, I think what you're describing is total rewards, which is a component of what we pay people in compensation, whether base, short-term incentives or long-term. But then when you mention benefits such as, I'm assuming you mean like health and welfare benefits,
right,
or
whatever the
retirement
benefits package.
That's what we call total rewards.
Okay.
So it's a little broader than compensation.
Okay. So of your total rewards, what percent is AIP of the costs? I'm looking at costs now just in terms of what we're going to have to be recovering. Of your total compensation costs, what percent is AIP? Is it like 3%, or even if you just compared it to base salary? How much of an incentive bonus can employees get?
Well, so I believe your first question was how much of AIP is part of total rewards?
Yeah.
And I don't have that number. That would have to be, it's really a detailed calculation that we would have to do, because different employees are getting opportunity at certain pension levels versus 401k versus that whole array of total rewards. But I think your second question actually focused more on what percentage of AIP is part of our total cash compensation. And what I can explain a little further, you said, how do we know how much people are getting? And we do vary the level of AIP opportunity based upon their job level. So certain grades are
what's the range? I understand some might be 2%, some might be 10%, but I'd like to know what the range of potential AIP benefit would be to an employee.
So I believe our lowest opportunity level is 6% for some individual contributor exempt employees. And as we go up through our grade structure, the people who are part of our standard grade structure, those levels go up, I believe. Actually, can I look to something?
Sure,
just to
absolutely.
Double check? Not sure if I have it. I don't think I have that with me, but I believe the levels would be some either at 50% or slightly above 50%, and those are for our more senior level executive positions.
So of their base pay, structure. They could get 50% more of their base pay as an a bonus
based on those performance metrics.
Yep. Okay. And so that helps explain. I was not clear on in the line on your rebuttal testimony that said the cost greater than 25% of base pay. So you would only be recovering in here up to 25% if an employee, say Dave over there, had a 50% bonus that he could have earned. He'd only get 25% covered.
Yes, and I should add that the high majority of all of our eligible employees are at 25% or lower.
Okay.
In those levels, those opportunity levels.
All right. In planning for this, does the company assume they're going to be paying the full amount?
I'm sorry, can you restate that? When you
well,
say
if you've got up to 25% increase in a compensation to an employee, that's a huge variable. How does the company plan for maybe they don't meet it? Or do you just assume everybody does?
Well, I'm in HR, but not an accounting expert. But what we do is in our compensation area, we provide eligibility data to our finance and accounting area. Mm-hmm. And we do assume that target level opportunity is accrued throughout the year. But then they make adjustments in that based upon how the business is trending and so forth. So, again, that would be not in my area of expertise, but we do accrue for that and plan for that.
I don't know that I need to know this, but target level opportunity, what is that?
Target level opportunity means that when we look to these third-party salary surveys and compensation surveys, when we receive information in there that at certain jobs it's, for example, in a very simple example, if you were working with an employee that was earning $50,000 annually, and if their target opportunity was $10,000, that target amount is what we're seeing coming out of the survey data. So it's not the actual amount that's paid out that we see in survey data, but it's the target opportunity that one could earn for an annual incentive.
Okay. So going back to the percent here, if you've got a range of the compensation cost that goes from 2% to 50%, and we disallowed AIP altogether, that would be a huge, significant amount of money that would not be allowed for cost recovery. Right?
Yes. It's
not just 2 or 3%. You're talking, this is a big component of your compensation packages, AIP.
The AIP, as a percentage. When we look, if your question is, how do I respond to that? What we look to is, these are what we consider competitive pay levels, and so we look to total cash compensation, and that is a driving factor in how we want to retain our talent and attract new talent. So we consider paying annual incentive as a key factor in how we compensate. So it's not just base salary, it is also incentive opportunity.
Okay, how long has the company been using AIP?
I don't have an exact year, but I believe it's been in place for many, many years. So I would have to get back to you if you need an exact.
Well, an approximate 10 years, 20, that'd be good to know. Let's see here. And then how does an employee get an increase in their base salary?
What we have annually is an opportunity to earn a merit increase. So I had mentioned earlier that our employees have a performance management system in place, or leaders do with their employees, to assess the performance of each employee, and they receive ratings based on that, on how they're performing throughout the year. And so a merit opportunity is where we again watch what our surveys are saying as general merit opportunity that would be delivered. We look to those survey sources to set those merit budgets. But annually, when we conclude our performance year, which is our fiscal year, we rate people based on how they're performing, and then we conduct a merit opportunity cycle, and leaders assess how their employees are doing, and that's their opportunity to say, with discretion, how certain employees are performing based on their performance rating and the role that they're in. And so that's their opportunity to make a change to their employee's base salary.
Okay. And that's an annual opportunity as well?
We have been conducting that annually.
Okay.
For our non-bargaining employees.
Okay. I think that concludes my questions. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Commissioner Fedorchik. Commissioner Kalk.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Sharon. This was a lot of fun, right?
Yes.
How long have you been with the company, you said?
It'll be 6 months, I think, next week.
What an opportunity, right? I appreciate your answers to all the questions. Just a couple to clarify. When you've been making comments about employees, are you talking about employees that work for NSP doing business as Xcel Energy exclusively? Are you talking about employees that for that company as well as employees that work for Xcel Energy, Inc.?
Well, our compensation programs are really done and organized centrally so that we have the same compensation philosophy and structure.
So your comments are dealing with not only the regulated company as well as the privately held company, if you will.
I would quantify that as these are compensation programs that apply to all of our non-bargaining employees. And so if your specific question is related to the OPCOs versus service company.
We don't regulate Xcel Energy, Inc. So are you talking about some of the employees' compensations that work for that company?
The compensation programs that I've described here today do apply to all of our non-bargaining employees.
So does that mean yes?
Yes, that would include the services company.
Okay, because I'm trying to – this is always a point of contention whenever we get the salary, because you have MDU Resources, MDU Utilities, Otter Tail Corporation, Otter Tail Utilities. And it's very confusing for me, commissioners, and others to understand the rate pay structure, because someone working for Xcel Energy, Inc. gets paid, that's their own business. It's coming out of their own investor dollars. But it is our business when we get into what people are getting paid for. They get part of their salaries out of the regulated part of it. So what I'm trying to get a feel for is, take someone like Laura, who testified this morning, did a great job in her testimony. Is her salary all dedicated to the regulated portion of the company, or some of her salary come from the non-regulated portion of the company?
You know, I'm probably not the best person to answer that because I don't know how we break out which employees are assigned to which operating company. Again, when I work on our compensation programs, they apply to all of those business lines.
I think that's a big point of clarification, because if we're going to take investor-owned dollars potentially and provide it for a compensation plan for someone that is not even in a regulated employee pool, that's not a good setup, whether we've done it or not in the past. So that's also maybe we'll ask that question to our attorney on the break, but that's a big point, so I don't know how we would tie that up. I mean, do you understand the question I'm asking?
Yes.
Maybe I'm not asking it. I'll ask your attorney. Are you tracking what I'm driving at here?
Thank you, Commissioner Culk. We do, and we think that there's another witness, Ann Hoyer, that would be able to address that.
All right, then I'll let that go then. Okay, thank you. I was looking at the website here while you're talking. You show a vacancy of 85 employees for the company all over the country. Seems like that's not very many employees that you're short right now, considering the size of your company. So do you really have a shortage of hiring employees when you just have that small number of vacancies for such a large company?
You know, I'm not as in touch with what our staffing group is working on with talent acquisition opportunities. So I don't know that whether the website is showing reflects all open positions. So I would not be the best person to ask about whether that's reflective of every open position we have.
So what can you point to maybe in the record then, if you're trying to connect the dots, that you need this plan to recruit and retrain good people, that shows that you maybe have had challenges hiring people?
Well, I think the focus of my rebuttal testimony focused a lot on some of the complexities and challenges that we've had in the nuclear space. And I know that there are a number of open positions in there, and I think there's a number quoted in that document as well. But I know some of the stories or the anecdotal kind of responses that we've had from our talent acquisition or our recruiting group talk about the challenges of really trying to get new talent in the door in those critical areas.
Okay, so, and I think that for me, just speaking for myself, just what I picked up today and read before, I view the employees dealing with the nuclear energy side of it is their own category. I'm not, to what I've talked about before, I'm looking at that more, the people not in that field, if you will. The last question, you made the comment to our attorney about, you know, the companies you're talking about, other companies do this all the time. Are you referring to other companies that are investor-owned utilities, or are you referring to other companies like Coke and Pepsi that have the same type of incentive plans?
So I think you were referring to when I made the statement that other companies use market-based compensation approach,
right,
if that's correct?
Yes.
Okay, so when I made that reference, I was referring to, I think, specifically the third-party surveys that we look to. So I can expand a little bit further on that comment. So, and it doesn't have to be specific to utility company experience, but if you are an organization that practices market-based compensation philosophy, you are looking to see what other similarly situated companies are out there. Like in our case, we are looking to surveys specific to utility company or investor-owned utilities.
So you are comparing yourself
to we do that, yes.
Investor-owned somewhere else in the country.
Yeah, so we actually look to surveys that are specific to utility benchmarking and companies that are our size. But when I made that statement earlier, it can be in general industry practices, too, that that companies that look to market-based approaches, they look to quantifiable data like third-party surveys to benchmark themselves about how they're paying. And so that was the reference I made.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Call. Commissioner Christman?
Ms. Koenig, are you the expert on the pension fund issues that Ms. McCartan discussed earlier? About that, you know, maybe there's a possibility of smoothing the needs over a longer period of time?
Actually, I'm not. My area of focus is compensation, so I wouldn't be able to address those pension questions.
Okay. Then I have no more questions, Judge Fetch.
All right, thank you. Thank you. Ms. Valley, did you have any redirect?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Norrell?
Yes, Your Honor. Ms. Koenig, you had stated when Ms. Jeffcoat Sacco had mentioned, you said that the API is tied to corporate performance, and you mentioned how there was the earnings per share requirement and everything. Doesn't this, in fact, benefit the shareholders of NSP as opposed to the ratepayers?
So if you were referring to the EPS funding factor that I mentioned, I think that it actually does benefit our customers as well as shareholders. But more importantly, what that does is it shows that we are looking at our financial performance and we're prudently looking at whether we have the available funding to pay out an annual incentive. So while our annual incentive program has operating metrics that very directly speak to reliability and safety and other important areas of those scorecards that directly benefit our customers, what it also does is it makes sure that as a publicly owned company, we're also looking to that that EPS factor to make sure that we have the affordability to pay it. We wouldn't want to be in a position where we're paying out an incentive when we're really not achieving those earnings outcomes that we're striving for.
But then that still protects the shareholder, doesn't it? Because then they're insulated against the loss.
Well, I would say that it protects both, the customers as well. If we're paying out on an annual incentive program, for example, that really we could be put those funds towards other investments that we're making in capital, for example. So we are paying out on an annual incentive plan when we achieve target results or something in our threshold target or up to above target opportunity. So we pay out when there's performance, and it is variable pay.
So if an employee meets all of their performance metrics, I think was the term you'd use, but the company doesn't meet their earnings per share requirement, how would that employee be compensated?
Well, because of that affordability trigger, and if that did not get met for that annual incentive program year, the employee or other employees like them would not receive a payout. So because it is variable in nature, they would not be getting an annual incentive payout that year because the company did not perform on all of their metrics that were required.
So even though that employee may have exceeded their performance, they'd still be, use the term baseline employee, they'd still be treated like a baseline employee even though their performance was above that baseline.
I don't recall the term baseline employee, but I think I understand what you're saying. But I can offer up a different way that employee would be recognized for their contribution. So while in that event, if that funding factor was not met and we were not able to pay out an annual incentive program payout that year, another way an employee could be recognized for their individual contribution is actually in the merit cycle opportunity, which I described further for the commissioners here, that is an opportunity to recognize an individual's performance and assess whether they should receive an increase in their base salary.
And just a question clarifying that merit opportunity, is that contingent upon the supervisor bringing that to the company, or is that mainly on the employee? Who presents that? Does that, maybe my question is not clear enough.
So I think your question is how does that occur annually? Correct. Is it employee driven or leader driven, or is it a cycle that we go through?
Correct.
And it is not an employee directed or driven initiative. What we do as an HR organization is that we offer that opportunity to recognize individual employees for their performance throughout the year, and we do that in what's called an annual merit cycle. So it is a process that we go through, and we assess what our budget is for that, and we hold leaders accountable to what those budgets are and how much is an affordable amount that we can put towards a merit increase that would affect their base salary. So it is coordinated by HR. Leaders work with that opportunity, and then they participate in that event with their employee.
Okay. Thank you. No further questions, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, any further questions?
I'm not sure if you're the right person to ask. I did wonder if the nuclear issue, the attracting and retaining nuclear employees, if the cost of that incentive program was disproportionately high compared to the general, the rest of the company. If there was, you know, you had to invest more in the incentive program for nuclear than the relative amount for everybody else. Can you answer that, or is that the witness that's coming to answer that?
Well, I would say that the details of what those costs are and the dollars and of the recovery that we're requesting associated with this case would be more for Ms. Hoyer.
Okay, thank you. So,
commissioners, any further questions? Commissioner Fedorchuk.
I have two more that I should have asked before but missed them. In your testimony that you read today, you say we propose to cap our recovery of these costs at 25% of base pay. This cap essentially precludes rate recovery of the costs, providing incentive compensation to executive-level employees. Why does that preclude the executive-level employees?
Well, what is meant by that is that leadership or management or even executive level that is has the opportunity for their AIP at a percentage above 25%, for example, 30% in this case. 5% of that would not be part of our request for rate recovery. So what we are trying to do is to say that we're not asking for recovery on 100% of our costs. We're asking for what we see as a reasonable amount that would reflect 25% of base pay.
Precludes rate recovery of the costs, providing incentive compensation to executive-level employees. To me, that means that the executive team, their AIP isn't included in this. Would not be included in this. And what you just said leads me to believe that 25% of it would be. So if theirs was 50%, say 50% of their AIP was 50%, then 25% would be.
The example I just gave was to kind of illustrate about the difference of someone at a 30% target, but the exact numbers of how that is calculated might be best answered by Ms.
Okay.
Hoyer.
All right. And then maybe she's the one to also address why the company is going from 15% to 25%. Previously, you had recovery of 15% of AIP costs, and now you're asking for 25%. I'm curious why.
Well, we believe that that is a reasonable cost of doing business because we look to what is market competitive and the median pay practices for total cash compensation, and we feel that that is a reasonable cost. But I, again, as I mentioned earlier, I don't know the history of that background.
Okay. Thank you, Sharon.
Thank you.
Any other questions from commissioners? Okay. Any further questions?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Norrell, anything further?
No, Your Honor.
No, thank you.
All right, thank you. Ms. Koenig, you are excused. All right, Ms. Gingrey, do you need a few minutes break? All right, we are going to just take a 10-minute break, be back. We're going to reconvene at about 2 minutes after 4:00.